Great. Yeah, right. Good morning. It's good to see you. And I'd like you to give another round of applause to David. Really busy man. Big time of year. GCSEs, A-levels and all of that. And he's here at Greenbelt. A round of applause. And in the car, I discovered the most important thing about David, actually, as we drove across, that David, you are a Cardiff City supporter.
Who said hooray?
So, tell us, what does a National Schools Commissioner actually do?
That's a really good question. So it depends which one. I'm the fourth. There have been three before me. And my background is, like many of you in the audience, I went to school, I went to university, then I went back to school again. So this year is 35 years in education. So my background is teacher, head, ran a group of schools in Bristol. And so the answer to your question, to be succinct, is I think the National Schools Commission is trying to be about trying to make the education system better for children. My predecessor's job would have been about purely about the structural solutions of schools becoming academies. I lead the academy program in England, but I lead it, I hope, through the lens of trying to say that the only reason why you would become an academy is because you want to make it better. So I think it's about school improvement.
So what we're going to do is talk for about half an hour, and then we're going to leave a quarter of an hour for you to ask your questions, yeah? So I'm absolutely sure I will miss the most important question, and you'll think about what it is. So you'll get a chance, we'll all get a chance to talk about this. So, David, everyone was talking about what they think education is. What does the National Schools Commissioner think education is?
So you said, as part of your introduction, Steve, that this is a big week. It's GCSEs and it's A-levels. And, of course, that's massively important for the children and the families who've had young people go through that experience. But that's not what education is about. Education, I think, is about making a contribution towards a tolerant and understanding society where people recognise and celebrate difference as well as uniqueness. And education, for me, is about helping people see beyond the environment they've had their own experience of. So, you know, the beautiful singing that we heard, I would wager that the children who performed this morning will still be remembering performing in this tent in a year's time before they'll remember a maths lesson they'll have next week. Because I think it's about the broader things that education brings, that builds that life confidence and develops young people to become confident and really competent young adults.
So you've got a really captive audience here, because I suppose the one thing we've all got in common is we're interested, really interested in education, not just because we showed up in a tent, but because we've had an education. We've got kids, perhaps, who are having an education or going to have or have had an education. And if it's we're involved in education as professionals, one way or the other, but at least we've been to school. So what makes a good school, in your opinion? When you look at a school, as opposed to Ofsted, perhaps, I'm not trying to juxtapose the two, but what do you think makes a good school?
Well, I spend a lot of time trying to wrestle with that one, because I think one very quick answer to you would be, because Ofsted says it's good, but that's missing a point as well, because that's just one lens to look at that through. I think there are three answers to the question, I think. I think if you were asking parents, one of the most important things that a parent would want at school is to make sure that their child is happy and safe, which sounds maybe an outdated thing because it should be all about achievement and grades, which of course is important. But as a father myself, I wanted my children to be happy and safe. And my eldest two kids went to the school that I was the head at. So I had more than just a vested interest in making sure that was true.
They might have been safe. Were they happy that their dad was the boss?
My eldest son is 30, and he answers that question differently now to when he was 16. yes, it was. I mean, it was one of those decisions. I always had the threat, of course, that whenever they were difficult at home, that I was about to do an assembly, and they were going to come and sit on my lap in assembly. And when you're a lad in secondary school, that's a hell of a threat.
Something that means safe, but not altogether happy.
that's a That's a fair, yes, exactly. That's a good way to look at it. I think on a more sensible answer, I suppose, is I think there are probably three things. I think there is a really good link between the quality of the curriculum that children experience and how well it's taught. So the quality of teaching for me is still the ultimate test for any school leader to make sure that whenever a child goes from one classroom to another or from one teacher to another, there is a consistently strong element of teaching that understands my child, understands what my child has done in the past, what they're going to do next, and that what we're teaching them is relevant and challenging. I think the second part is around support. We talk about young people being disadvantaged, and that's a real national challenge. And I mean, you might ask me about that later, but I think the performance of our disadvantaged communities is one of our biggest civil rights challenges in this country. That's how I describe it. But actually, every child at some point often meets some kind of challenge. It may be quite small, but the idea that a four-year-old will get to 18 without meeting some obstacle is unrealistic. So a good school for me is the school that can really anticipate that and can support that youngster when it happens. But I'm also really interested in what happens outside of the classroom. You know, my own background is music. I was a musician. I did a music degree. I taught music. And for me, the arts are an important part of that dimension of good learning. And then I think the third part is how well is that school led and how well is it governed? And there's been a lot of talk recently about the quality of governance and do we have enough good governors? We have to remember, I think, that governance is still a voluntary act. People do it because they really believe in it. They don't seek any reward for it. But the expectations that we have of what governors will bring to school improvement is probably as challenging as it's ever been. And I take that responsibility very seriously. So the third axis is really that between governance and leadership of schools.
Going back to your second one, you talked about the arts being really important. You're at an arts festival. Tell us why arts are so important, not just to education, but I guess to society, therefore.
Well, this is an answer that comes from the heart, Steve, rather than a professional standpoint. I mean, my dad was a professional musician. My dad was a classical pianist. And so I learned to play the piano when I was 3 or 4 years. There's photographs of me in nappies banging a piano. It got better than that, but music has always been a really important part of my life and my upbringing, and continues to be. So it's from that standpoint that I'm probably not ambivalent about it. But I think there are three things. I mean, what the arts offer young people is the chance to create, the chance to respond emotionally, and the chance to feel. And whilst there'll be other people with different subject backgrounds who will argue that their subject does that as well, the whole essence of the arts is about emotional education, helping people to aesthetically understand something great. Whether you're creating a piece of artwork, whether you're making a piece of music, whether you're speaking somebody else's words in public, these are skills and experiences that I think are quite unique in the arts curriculum. And those of you who have been to school concerts, to school productions, or you teach, or young people who have recently left school themselves, I'm always amazed when a school performance takes place. The people giving the loudest response, the loudest cheer, are the children of their peers, because they respect and understand what they've had to do to be able to stand up there and do that.
Yeah, it was Sir Ken Robinson, wasn't it, who said famously, education doesn't help young people become creative. They are creative. It knocks the creativity out of them if we're not careful.
That's an interesting view. Having spent 20 years as a music teacher, that wasn't pinned to my office door, I have to say. But I think there is a risk that if you don't nurture that talent and you don't open people's eyes and ears to what the potential of arts can be in whatever context, whether it's dance, drama, visual art, music, or any other sphere of that, then I think it's a missed opportunity. But I've taught lots of young children, both boys and girls, who found school difficult. But they found the arts the means of unlocking it. So they would come more frequently when they had drama and music on the timetable, and were a little bit less frequent when it was triple science. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. So those of you who are science educators, please, that's not a statement about science. But the reality is that sometimes arts and sport as well unlocks the key to engagement for some young people that other subjects don't.
In other parts of my world, as at the education bit side, I'm involved, or Oasis involved, a lot with young people outside of education in terms of gangs and crime and violence, etc. We work inside a couple of hospitals, A&E, trying to work with kids who've ended up there because of violent crime. And I personally am doing quite a lot of work with the NHS at the moment, their 70th anniversary. And so I sat down the day after the 70th anniversary, a month or so back, with some of their with their leaders, and we were looking at the fact that actually the NHS is misnamed. It's not a national health service. You go to your the GP when you're sick, and you go to the hospital when you're even sicker. The health service is the rest of society, and Public Health England have just recently, in fact, the day before the anniversary, the 70th anniversary, they said the biggest health factor in Britain is education. So as we look towards education, because education leads on to employment, and employment leads on to income, and that leads on to a good built environment, et cetera, and then there's that whole societal bit as well, community bit as well. So as you look at education and you look at some of the huge social issues we're facing in this country, lack of tolerance, the marginalisation of deprived communities, et cetera, and our need to build capacity, what role do you think education's got in that?
So I would put it at the core of that. So I was, as you were describing that, I was visualising a circle in my head of all of the challenges that you said, and I think education sits in the heart of it. But I don't think education is the only public sector service that can solve it on its own. So Justine Greening, who was the Secretary of State for Education until the turn of this year, one of the reasons why I really enjoyed working for her...
I thought you were going to say until she said she was against grammar schools.
Would I make such a political comment with only 7 days of this job to go?
No, it's easier for me to say than you.
I couldn't possibly comment.
Anyway, Justine.
But she talked... She talked about social mobility, and she talked about it from the perspective of her own upbringing and her own experience, and I really bought into that. And one of the things that she did was she created, around the country, in some of those disadvantaged communities you described, 12 opportunity areas, which have education at the heart, but recognises that education on its own is not going to change anything. And so the way that educational leaders like you and I and others like us have got to have much more intelligent and collaborative conversations with health, with mental health, with justice, with the police, with a whole variety of providers, both public sector, private sector, and third sector, who together will galvanize the capacity to solve this problem. It's a massive challenge, and I don't underestimate how difficult it is.
What stands in the way of that integration?
I think there are a couple of things. I mean, you know, it would be really naive to say funding wasn't part of that, because these things don't happen just purely in goodwill. I think there's also probably quite a strong silo effect in our country, where people believe they have the answers to their parts of the question, and we need to do much more work cross-sector to think about how we share what we know and what's already working.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's also back to imagination in the end, isn't it? We need leaders who can see something different to... The way it is.
I absolutely agree with that. I think one of our challenges is that we sometimes look to the past to solve the problem better than we did before, rather than say, actually, that's not the answer. The answer, it hasn't been invented yet. And we need innovation and brave leadership, courageous leadership. But those courageous leaders need time, because those things aren't quick fixes. Yeah.
So there's lots of people, I guess, in this tent who are involved in education one way or the other professionally. But we also know, don't we, that it's hard to recruit people into education at the moment. It's hard to get science teachers, maths teachers. It's hard to get people to move out. You know, when the league... I know I don't need to tell you this, David. When the league tables come out, you know, the schools in the cities do better than the schools, you know, by the coast and some of the rural schools, because it's harder to get people to go there, live there, be embedded there to teach. You're looking at a whole tent of people who can change the destinies of tens and hundreds of thousands of people. How do we recruit and keep great educationalists.
So this I think is one of the really big challenges that we've got, and I think I welcome that politicians are now beginning to acknowledge there's a problem, because for quite some time they talked about it being, we've never had so many people coming into it, we've never had so many kids in the system, so therefore we need more teachers. So I think there's a realism around that now. There's a couple of things. First of all, I think the teaching profession has to be better at celebrating what it does. So I am so sick of reading on social media where somebody else has now panned this school or panned this particular educational initiative. I think the teacher unions could do more to celebrate the profession. I understand the important role that they play in challenging government. But actually, if I was in my second year at university thinking about teaching and I was reading some of the things that I hear and read about education, I'd think elsewhere as well. So we have to celebrate teaching as a great career. But when you get those people, there are two things that heads have got to be good at. One is you've got to develop teachers professionally. So that means really high quality training. But also paint the picture. What will it be like to be a teacher in 5 or 10 years' time? Don't just get through this year. What happens in 2 years, in 3 years? What are we going to offer you? How are we going to make you the best teacher that you can be, the best version of yourself? So the professional development of teachers has to be much more personalized, much more about where teachers are coming from. But the other really important bit is everybody who's a teacher in the school is also a parent, a son, a daughter, a nephew, a niece. They have nephews and nieces. And family stuff sometimes happens. And I sometimes feel that schools think their teachers are robots, that they leave their emotional feelings at the door and come into school. And the reality is that the best heads I work with and the head I hope I was understood that there are times when I have to be much more empathetic about that teacher's needs and their family in order to get them mended and repaired and feeling better so that in the future they'll be the teacher they wanted to be. But unless we develop the mental well-being, the health of our educational sector and the people who work within it alongside their professional development, we'll only ever have half the teachers we need.
I think that's a really important point, isn't it? I often think, you know, going back to your response about what education is about, well-being and health and capacity, the system can end up driving people whose whole task is to bring well-being to everyone, but their health and their well-being is falling apart because they're tested and tested and retested. How many times do you have to weigh the frigging pig, do you know, and all that kind of thing? So how do we get ourselves out of this teach to the test, over-testing thing?
So the answer to that is not to ask the government to make up a new policy. The answer to that is to give leaders the space and the time to improve their schools. So I've spoken a lot in the last couple of years about the truth that if you're talking about a school that's in real difficulties, it takes at least 3 years, if not longer, to turn that school around. And unless you have some silver magic bullet that you bought on Amazon, which I've not seen yet, that's the truth of the matter. And what I spend most of my time in the job I'm doing at the moment is trying to tell the difference between a school leader who is doing all of the right things, but the results haven't caught up yet, versus the school leader who just hasn't got a clue what to do next. And I think I have to provide a different level of support to both of those. But I mean, the testing system is important. So I do agree that sometimes for some children and teachers as well, it's a real health challenge, the frequency of that. But actually, our education system, even though things are getting harder and the curriculum is tougher and there is more testing, the quality of the workforce that we have that I see at the moment is as good as it's been. And teachers are so resilient. Every time something new comes along, they just deal with it and they make it work. Yeah. But I don't think that you can do that forever. And I think the solution to it and the antidote to that pressure is to recognize that we're talking about a system that's always going to be in a state of continual improvement and give people time to deliver what they said they were going to do.
Hmm. And some of, you know, my experience, I mean, we got, you know, hundreds, thousands of teachers working within OASIS. And I see the really best people go to the toughest situation. When Ed Balls, Ed was Secretary of State for Education, OASIS took on a really tough school, and it wasn't going well. It was in special measures minus, you know. They were trading the drugs in the corridors before we took the school on. That was just the teachers. That was to keep them out of it. And And anyway, we took on this school, and about 4 months in, I suppose, perhaps it was 5 months, I can't remember, I mean, we're getting some bad press. Well, you're going to get some bad press because we were stopping the drug dealing on the corridors, and some of the kids didn't like it, and some of the teaching staff didn't like it, to be honest. Not that we're stopping the drug dealing, but you bring discipline and you bring a new rigor. Anyway, so we got some really bad press locally. So Ed, it was much smaller than the academy's thing, Ed calls me in, and I sit in his office with him, and he said, "Steve, we gave you this school. When are you going to turn it round?" And I said to him, I've stayed in touch with him, he makes a much better television presenter and dancer than he did person at Understanding Education, which I've told him on several. He's brilliant, I think. He's a wonderful man. And he's been liberated by not being in that office, actually. I think he's fantastic. His series he's just done on Trump's America is brilliant. But he was stuck in that job, so he's under the cosh as well. And I said, Ed, I remember saying, Ed, you bring me your car that's not working, and I'm in a mechanic, and you bring it to me at 9 o'clock in the morning and say, I want it fixed by lunch. I say, well, Ed, go away. You know, come back at lunchtime, and I tell you, if it's kind of like a minor problem, like an oil change, you can have it back at tea time. If you've abused this car for the last 6 years, I'm going to have to rebuild the whole engine, and it's out of action for 3 months. So this kind of thing, how long does it take to turn around a failing school? Depends why it's failing, doesn't it? And it depends what the community's like.
So there are usually 3 or 4 things that contribute to that. And I think the first one of those is behaviour. So one of the things I spent a lot of my time as a head doing was building a team of people around me who were very visible leaders, so that when teachers were trying to teach and facing low-level disruption or something more aggressive than that, there was never a doubt that there was somebody with authority who could come and help and either remove that young person from the lesson or stay in the lesson and make sure that the learning continued. So the culture of behaviour is where you start for me. And out of that, teachers can teach better, children are learning better, there's less time spent on dealing with classroom management. But if you're facing that, if you're right in that at that time, that's one of the challenges why people leave the profession. So when you ask people, and various people have surveyed, why do teachers leave? The inability to be supported as a young teacher by your leadership team is one of the reasons that's often cited. And that's so fixable. There is nothing that a deputy head should be doing on an email that's more important than helping the NQT struggling with bottom set year 10.
A question that I became aware of just because of a group that I'm meeting with at the moment of Black and Asian and minority ethnicity leaders, just trying to do some work around that, is I was informed by one of the members of that group that we put together that I think there are just over 3,000 secondary schools in the country, aren't there, state secondary schools in the country. And there are, last year, according to one of the head teachers in this group, there were 32 black head teachers. 3,000 schools, 32 black head teachers. Yeah. What do we do to increase the diversity? I'm not just thinking about black teachers, but obviously part of education is role modelling, isn't it? So what do we do about this situation? Is this something you've been thinking about?
Yes, it is one of the things I've been thinking about, and I think it's difficult because I think fundamentally what I'm looking for is great leaders first, diversity second. But there's a challenge around that statement, which is very easy for me to trot out this morning, which is if you're leading a community that is so alien to your own experience, your quality as a leader will get you so far. Because there's something about the empathy and the understanding of the community challenge. So the family for whom education is a challenge for their child is probably also experiencing challenges around social care, around housing, around benefit access, around feeding the family. Education is just one more problem to solve. And one of the things I think that we need to do better over the next 5-10 years as educationists is recognize the role of the educational leader as a leader within the community as well. And that means understanding some of the challenges that these faces. I read this week, a report that said 43 children are excluded from schools in this country every day. 23,000 schools, 43 kids a day are excluded. Now, some of those exclusions will be justified. And I don't think we can ever say it's not, because as a head, extreme violence from one child to another or from a child to an adult was a red line. But a lot of those 43 children are being excluded in what I call the three strikes and out rule. You get one more chance, one more warning, and that's it. But I've recently been appointed to the charity as a trustee, Centrepoint, which is the brilliant charity that works on reducing youth homelessness between 16 and 25. And it's just been such an eye-opener. And at any one time in Centrepoint foyers, there are around about 1,300 beds from 16 to 25-year-olds, and as you'd expect, they're full. But over 50% of those beds are filled by young people who didn't get to the end of year 11, who either voted with their feet and stayed at home, or they were excluded. And that's one of the real challenges that education has got to grip better. I think it's great that we have so many outstanding schools in the country. I think it would be even better if they were outstanding with the schools they had, rather than the children they had, rather than the children that they wanted.
And then all that ties into our growing understanding of brain development, doesn't it? And why a kid kicks off and why they switch. You know, if I throw a strop, if I lose it, that's not the same thing. That's different, isn't it, to a kid kicking off who's 13, who's never been loved, never appreciated. There's no one stable in their life. They watch their dad beat their mum black and blue. He's now in et cetera, et cetera. So we got to catch up educationally with what we're understanding scientifically about our brains, haven't we?
We do.
Exclusion, I mean, an exclusion means someone else has got to include.
Yeah. And the reality for schools is that if I run a school where I've got 200 empty places, I get them. And I've already got my fair share of young people I'm trying to hold on to. So there is something about the morality of schools who are popular and full, excluding children they can't cope with. My view is, and one of the things I would change if I was Secretary of State for a day would be that the league tables are based upon the children that you had when you were in year seven, whether they're with you or not. And actually, if you exclude a child at 14, you'd better find out where they're going and make sure that provision is good. Otherwise, we lose them, I think, in that respect. But I mean, your point about the way that behavior changes with all of the kind of the neurons that are developing in young people, this is what the modern teacher in 2018 has to contend with. And when I talked before about training and well-being, it's actually training in that area as well, to understand why is it that this child behaves beautifully for me and I'm really engaged with it, but the bell goes, they go next door and they change. That's got to be about barriers, it's got to be about standards, it's got about saying, you know, these are our expectations. I think that some of the schools that have some of the firmest behavior policies engage those disadvantaged children better because they set some boundaries up. And what you described as what a young person might be challenged is a lack of boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I fundamentally believe that children like boundaries. They might kick against it and tell you that they don't, and you're the authority figure, and who are you to tell me? But fundamentally, schools are about boundaries. Mm.
So, David, we've talked about some of the issues. You're retiring from this job. You're leaving this job at the end of this month.
Yeah, Friday.
So next Friday. So what are you most proud of in terms of what you've achieved as Schools Commissioner over the last 3 years?
4 years in the DfE was a bit of a task. that's a joke.
I know it wasn't. That was a joke officially. Right.
Yeah. I think I came into the role wanting to try to test, I suppose, myself, but test whether or not somebody with my background, having been a teacher, a head, could go into a senior position in government and not lose sight of the values that I hope were there when I was a head. And so I tried to do the role very much from the point of view of understanding the challenge of school leaders, where there was a conversation that needed to happen around standards, I did it, but I always tried to lead them with something that helped them to speed up their journey. I talked a lot about the ways in which I thought good practice around the country could be shared with other people. And I inherited a team of 8 regional schools commissioners who, this will be a technical definition, but those of you that know the academy world will be familiar with the multi-academy trust concept. My 8 RSCs were 8 standalone academies pretending to play nicely together. And I think when I leave next week, they are genuinely a team that are now more than the sum of the parts. And I think that's important. I think the other thing I'd say is that I had my leaving due at the DfE this week, and there's about 200 people came to it. So either that's good because they're really glad I'm going, or they genuinely wanted to say goodbye. But I used the quote from Maya Angelou, and she talked about people often forget what you said. They often forget what you did, but they never forget how you made them feel. And even in the toughest conversations I've had, I hope people feel that I did that with respect.
And what are you going to do next day? I'm sure they think that. You know, I've got to know you a little bit, and I see your passion. So, and your passion for young people. So what are you going to do now? I can't believe you're going to play golf.
Well, I do play golf, actually. But not 5 days a week. So I'm going to take a break. I mean, the civil service has this quaint thing that when you leave it, you have to have a period of gardening leave in case you say something you shouldn't, which I've already done this morning, probably. But that's fine. I'll take September and October and have a rest and spend some time with my wife and my family.
You see, I didn't ask you the question. When you said, if I was Secretary of State for a day, I would do that. I didn't follow up with the question, what else would you do? Because I was afraid you might say all sorts of things you'd get into trouble for.
Yeah, Steve knows me well. So I'm going to divide my work into two things. I've told you about Centrepoint, so that's really important to me. It feels like it's got the right, not the right moral purpose. It's the right thing for me to do right now. And I've also joined the board of the Teaching Awards group because I think, in answer to my question earlier about it's so important we celebrate teaching, I think I could play a role in that. But my professional role, the bit I want to do in terms of putting back into the system. I'm going to set up a leadership college for multi-academy trusts, and I'm going to continue to work with great CEOs and great school leaders in a way that's slightly different outside government, but hopefully equally valuable.
I think that's really needed. We've talked about that. But there's 15 minutes left to run, and rather than me ask, I'd love to ask David some questions about that. But rather than doing that, it's really important that you ask David your questions. And what? And you, if you want to ask a question, you've got to come and queue up. There you go. So here's the first question.
So it was really lovely to hear you talk about the importance of the breadth of the curriculum and what you talked about arts. And we're a festival about arts, but we're a festival about faith as well. So I'm sure you'd agree, RE is important for all children in all schools. But in 42% of academies, no RE is taught for children aged 14 to 16.
Yeah. We take three questions at once. No, sorry. Yeah.
What can we do about that in the future? That needs to change.
Yeah.
I echo that as an RE teacher who is looking for a job still. My question is, you've talked passionately about the importance of the arts in the curriculum.
Yes.
Can you give us a crumb of hope? Because at the moment, that is what is being cut in all the schools. Where's the hope?
RE and arts.
How do you see the future role of school governors? I've recently become governor, and my fear is that too many people are being dissuaded from being governors and therefore getting diversity on governing bodies because of the extreme workload that is expected in areas of great detail.
RE, arts and governorship, not much to deal with.
I might take that in the reverse order then. So I think the question about governance is a very important one. And I mean, your question almost mirrored what I said earlier on about it's not the role it was 10 years ago, or maybe even 5 years ago. It's much more challenging around that. And I think part of the answer lies to a degree in training, I think. I think people come in with all of the right moral purpose and all the expectation about wanting to make a difference, but they're expected to understand at the first meeting what they're meant to be doing, and it's complex. It's complex whether it's governance in the maintained sector or in the academy sector. So I think better training is part of that. I think where it comes to chairs and clerks and vice chairs, I've said for some time, I think we need to put that on a professional footing. A number of chairs give up time from their professional lives, which their employers will presumably be happy with, but if it's 2 or 3 days a week, as it can be, that's quite a challenge. And if you've gone into semi-retirement, that's 2 or 3 days a week you thought you'd be doing something else. So I think we do need to, whether that's an honorarium or whether it's just a recognition of that, I think we have to just, it's not just about volunteering anymore in that respect. The arts one.
Crumb of hope.
Well, I think there is a crumb of hope there because the government's target, I think, for EBAC is 75%. And it's around about 45% now, and it's been at that kind of figure for 2 or 3 years. And I think what heads are saying is that we recognise that for some of our children, this suite of subjects really works. But actually, we still really want children to carry on doing these other subjects. My biggest fear is that heads who don't understand or don't appreciate the arts will see it relegated to an extracurricular slot. And my experience tells me that you don't get great drama extracurricular or music extracurricular unless it's really good in the classroom, because the children won't come if they don't have a great classroom experience. So I think it's in the hands of leaders and governors, but it links into your question really, about saying what really matters to our community is that our children do the arts, and therefore we should do that.
And RE, ethics, yeah. Values, morality.
Well, the point about 42% of academies not doing it, but where does the lady gone who asked me that question? Sorry, yeah. So I know that's true. And my worry is I think it might get worse. And it probably gets worse because of the curriculum narrowing, not the breadth of it. And I worry about the answer that says, but RE is everywhere. That whole ethos is taught through PSE. No, it's not. No, it isn't. And I think one of the things that was a mistake in, well, this is my view, I don't think the minister will tell you this, but my view is, why didn't RE get included within the suite of subjects for EBAC? That would have been a move that would have done it, because it feels like the academic rigor around history and geography is every bit as relevant in RE. So I think there's a pressure in terms of the curriculum being squeezed. I'm not giving you an answer. I'm telling you more about why there's a problem. But again, I think my answer to yours is very similar to the one to the arts question. I think this is where governing bodies have to take a stand and say, we believe this is important to our young people and we need to do it. My fear is that what they do is they place it into key stage three, in 11 to 14, and teach it in primary. But actually, when we get to GCSE, when teenage views and values are really being honed even more in more depth, that's the point they really need that teaching. So I think it's something that is absolutely, in my mind, as a challenge that was an unintended consequence of that policy.
Great, we've got 10 minutes to go. Three more questions.
Right. The research evidence shows, David, that most of the things that make a difference in education are relational, not structural. And yet our schools aren't really set up for that. They're large, they're system-driven, children are anonymous. School doesn't work for many children, not just those who are disadvantaged. Do we need to reimagine schools in quite a different way?
I speak as a chair of a small MAT, likely to merge with two other MATs fairly soon. In all three, the accounting officer doubles as head teacher. Yeah. I'd like you to describe for me how you see the role of chief executive officer.
A MAT is a multi-academy trust. An accounting officer is the person who's ultimately responsible for a MAT.
Morning, Steve.
Good morning.
I pay for my daughter's education, and I know half the room have just judged me for that. But if you know me, you'd know there's a reason for that. I just wanted to say that the local school is a free school, but then they are not the centre of the catchment. They've been allowed to use a postcode 2 miles away. By the way, I live in Bristol, so you'll know. The other two schools were academies, not an Oasis one. They both rejected her. We put her in to the entrance exam. She got accepted into a fee-paying school. I spent every penny of my working-class father's inheritance for me, bar £20, to pay for her education. I work in a special educational needs school, all the children on the autistic spectrum. We can't give a place to everybody, and we select. The other factors as well, any decent school, depends how you judge it, any decent school in Bristol, the cost of me moving into their catchment is more than the fees that I pay for my daughter. My question is this, having said all that, have we created a context in the reality that all education is now selective?
Do you remember those?
The first question was about structures versus relationships, which I thought was good. So I'm gonna have to speed up my answers, aren't I, here? Yes, I agree. We've come thankfully through a period where simply becoming an academy was deemed to be the solution to a school getting better. You still had to do something inside that school to make it better. But I agree with you that the challenge of being a young person in a secondary school of 1,500 is very different to being a six-year-old in a primary school of 50. And I think the a lot of the answers I've given to you this morning were about the way in which people build relationships between adults and children and children and children. And I do worry about the scale of that. It's not impossible, but you have to think differently about that. You talked about the reconceptualization of it. If we were going to reconceptualize it, I think I would stop thinking about primary and secondary as a divide, and I would think about education institutions that, that educate from nursery right the way through to post-16, so that there's a group of people understand that child's journey from 2 to 19. That feels to me to be one thing that I would think about.
And then this gentleman down here asking the question about maths and accounting officers, yep, and the role of head teachers. Yep. It's a big one. I guess that's what your leadership school is going to be partly about.
Yes, it will. So the chief executive officer, the CEO, who has leadership responsibility for a group of schools in the Military Academy Trust, is by definition the accounting officer as well. And when you talked about being accountable for it, the CEO is accountable to the board. And sometimes where it's gone wrong, the CEO doesn't think they're accountable to anybody. So being accountable to the board is my answer in a nutshell. I could give you a longer one, but we won't get all through the answers. That's the fundamental issue. Yeah. And the last one was about...
isn't all education becoming selective, particularly in Bristol?
Well, I mean, Bristol is somewhere that's very close to my heart. And I think what happened in Bristol was quite remarkable, given in 2003 it was 152nd out of 154 authorities, and last year it was 21st. So something good is happening in Bristol. But I do understand the spirit of the question. And I think selection, if we use that word, works in two ways. There's selection where schools set up a model by which they select children for particular reasons, let's call it ability. I'm not sure that a modern society should accept that. But I also think there's a challenge about selection via catchment, via house prices, via properties. And what it does is it reinforces the disadvantaged community syndrome.
But by whether anybody wants to go and live in that town or on that estate, yeah, and teach in the first place, yeah, by whether there's an intercity train, by whether it's near a big train station. Do you know, I watch across our group of schools, yeah, David, we run 51 schools, that, you know, when the GCSE results come out, there's one way of reading them, which is educational, if you like. There's another way of reading them, which is which schools are near the biggest railway stations? Which schools have the fast roads into? Which schools are in towns with theatres where people want to live? Yeah. All of that creates selection, yeah, as well, doesn't it?
But selection for the workforce. And the one of the challenges which the government, successive governments have tried to wrestle with is, do you pay everybody the same rate of pay for teaching in a comparatively easier suburb of the country to work in, where it's less turbulent, as you pay somebody in an area where it's completely different? And how do we incentivize for young people to go and live in areas, yeah, which they don't know but can make a difference, yeah, to?
We need people with a vision. Three more questions. We can only take, if you're in the queue and you're late, I'm sure David will answer it. Hang around for a little bit and answer your questions. But let's hear these questions quickly and let David respond, and then we'll finish.
Thank you. I'm the head teacher of a highly inclusive secondary school. I'm the father of two children with special educational needs. It's my perception that we are creating a school system that discriminates against those who have SEN. I would value your comments, please.
My question is also about SEN, because I'm a special needs officer, and what I and my parents and my schools want to see is us celebrating every single small step of progress that our special needs children make. But at the moment, they are all judged against one standard, and that's SATs and GCSEs and A-levels. What is the government going to do about celebrating those schools who are the most inclusive and measuring children against their own starting point and not against one standard?
Great. That's two SEN questions, and thank you.
I come from Buckinghamshire. I know you've touched on this already a little bit. 80% of our children are told at the age of 10, 10 and a half, that they are less worthy of investment than the other 20%. If you were me and my children, how would you be fighting against this? Because I'm not feeling as grateful as Theresa May seems to think I should.
Easy ones to finish with.
Well, I'll try and take the first two together, because although they were framed slightly differently, they are thematically linked, aren't they? I think in that. So, So in a way, I it's quite helpful because I think it goes back to how you asked me at the beginning of this conversation about the value and what is a great education. So I think my answer to your question is that a great education system has got to start from the needs of those children, not think about them as a consequence of what we did for everybody else. So we have to have different measurement metrics. Progress is absolutely vital, and progress doesn't happen for any child within the space of a single lesson, but even less so, I suspect, with young people for whom the journey is actually both forwards and backwards within the course of a school day. So the assessment of progress needs a close look at that. I think it's also about the assessment and the support for children with special educational needs in terms of what happens next. Because one of the things which I think is a real challenge for our country is that we assume that education is done when you've done your GCSEs and A-levels. It's not. It starts. That's a starting point, because at that point you have to take what you've learned into society and do something with it. One of the things in my Be a Secretary of State for a Day thing was, our lead tables should find some way of calculating what young people do by the time they're 25. As a result of that education that they had. And that would absolutely be right for children with SEN, for whom their care and support as adults has to continue long beyond school days are finished. So you won't find a bigger advocate for me about that inclusive policy around it. But the measurement of progress rather than raw attainment is a blunt tool. The attainment's a blunt tool. The progress has more traction in it. And the third question was about Buckinghamshire and about selective education. And I'm going to be find it very difficult. Where's the lady who asked the question? Did she go back? I don't think I can be terribly balanced about this, because I don't believe in selective education. So, but I'm also not going to be even if I was staying in my job, I don't think I'd have the influence to change it, because selective education is here. I think where the ray of hope would come for me. Would be in Buckinghamshire, that there are lots of schools for whom they are in reality secondary moderns, not comprehensives, but they don't let that worry them. They take the view that they're going to try to outperform the grammar schools. They're going to try to do as well as they possibly can. They're going to provide something that's slightly different. And maybe their argument might be that actually as a result of that, they'll produce more rounded young people than their selective partners.
And if I might just chip in, you see, to everyone, I think the church in the UK, your church, i.e. you know, we have a huge role to play in all of this. So that I lead a church in Waterloo, and we began a secondary school in an office block. 71% of the kids that took GCSEs just now are pupil premium. 71%. And basically, we knocked it out of the park. David and I were talking about this. This school, in an office block, with 71% pupil premium kids, will probably finish in the top 10 very best state schools in the country. It's a bit early to say. We might be in the top 5, but we would definitely be in the top 10, because it's about a whole church. It's about whole community, isn't it? So we're more empowered than perhaps we think we are. We're more empowered than perhaps we think we are. You can ask about more of that. I've just been given this. It tells me that I and Jill and various others, Emma, who's here, Emma Johnson is one of our Oasis head teachers, and Emma took over the school on Benefit Street. Do you remember Benefit Street program? At the same time as Benefit Street, and talked to Emma at 2 o'clock about the extraordinary turnaround there. And Emily down here, who was leading the choir here with Flick. We're all going to be at the Oasis stand at 2 p.m. if you want to find out more about education and what you can get involved in your community, or join in on Monday. Not today. There you are, plenty of warning. 2 p.m. on Monday, we're going to be there. David, one last thing. It's what would you say to us to send us out from this place? Because it's easy for us to analyse the problem, isn't it?
Wow. I would say that in the realms of education, the key to a prosperous, civilised country is that everybody in this room carries on learning. education doesn't just happen for the young, it happens for everybody throughout their lives. We learn more from the mistakes that we make than we do from the things that we get right. I certainly have, anyway.
Thank you. A huge round of applause for Sir David Carter.